have a very special guest today. His name is John Hanna. He is a senior fellow at the Institute for Near East Policy, served as Vice President Dick Cheney's assistant for national security affairs, former State Department official, worked under UN Ambassador John Bolton, a graduate of Yale Law School, and the New York Times called him Cheney's bureaucratic master. Mr. Hanna, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks very much, Ty. If I can just correct, I'm actually now a fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies.
Okay. All right. I appreciate you making that correction. That even more and more takes me into the question number one here. How important was the drone strike that eliminated al-Awlaki this past week? Obviously, he's a al-Qaeda leader and a U.S. citizen. Tell me how important that was.
I think it was critical, Ty. al-Awlaki was particularly uniquely dangerous. He was a U.S. citizen. He understood American culture, incredibly savvy in new media, had a charismatic figure, had an ability to inspire American Muslims in a unique way. And the best example of that, of course, was the tragic instance of Major Nidal Hassan at Fort Hood and the massacre, which was clearly connected to al-Awlaki. So he was particularly dangerous, and his death leaves a big hole in al-Qaeda.
And I think that's outstanding, and I'm all for killing the bad guys and killing them when we have the opportunity, but we hear these liberal pundits claiming he deserves constitutional protections. If you would, for our listeners, refute that.
Yeah, no, I think that particular legal claim is just misplaced, Ty. Congress gave the president the authority to use all necessary and appropriate force against al-Qaeda in 2001. It was a sweeping authorization that didn't put any limits based on citizenship or geography, that is, where the enemy combatant was found. There's no legal protection, not even for an American citizen who signs up with a hostile force that is at war with the United States, especially one that's on the lam in an ungovernable territory, a part of Yemen. There's no legal force field that protects an American citizen when he signed up with the enemy and turned into an enemy combatant.
Well put. Obviously, al-Qaeda has been injured as a result of this, but al-Qaeda is still a huge threat to us, are they not?
No question, Ty. I think it's been hurt. I think we've made progress since 2001, but there's no question that there is al-Qaeda and a range of other fanatical groups that remain determined to attack the United States, including through the use, if they can get their hands on them, through weapons of mass destruction. So I think, we've got to learn the right lessons, keep doing the things that we've done right the last 10 years, correct the things that we've done wrong, some of the mistakes we made, but stay vigilant and resolved to get this job done, because the success we have does not equate to victory.
Let me chase that about weapons of mass destruction just for a second. How important is it that we prevent Iran from getting nuclear weapons?
Ty, my own belief is that allowing this particular Iranian regime to acquire nuclear weapons would pose a dire threat to the vital interests of the United States. I mean, you got to remember who you're dealing with. It's a regime that's been at war with the United States for 30 years. It's the world's leading state sponsor of terrorism. It's helped kill thousands of U.S. soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's got a leadership, openly pines for a world without America, and incites day in and day out for genocide against the state of Israel, our closest ally in the Middle East. And the Treasury Department recently said that the Iranian regime had engaged in a multi-year alliance with al-Qaeda to attack the United States. And that's all, of course, before it's got nuclear weapons. So you can only imagine how much more dangerous and aggressive they'll become once they believe they have the shield of a nuclear deterrent protecting them.
Now, lately it seems to be more of a budgetary decision as opposed to a national security decision, whether or not we should be in Afghanistan or Iraq or in that region. Doesn't it make sense, and it does certainly to me, doesn't it make sense to fight those battles there on their soil as opposed to fighting them here in the U.S.?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth to that, Ty. You know, I think the budget pressures are real, though in reality, I think, you know better than anybody that the costs of our defense budget in the Iraq and Afghanistan operations, as expensive as they've been, pale as a long-term burden compared to our domestic entitlement programs, which are the real source of the existential
right.
danger that the country faces. You know, as much as anything, I think people are just tired and fatigued after a decade of fighting these wars and expending so much of our national treasure and our sons and daughters in faraway places that really, you know, and it's true, they don't seem to like or appreciate us very much. And I think that feeling of fatigue is very hard to combat, especially, unfortunately, when you do have a commander-in-chief whose entire presidency and really every ounce of his fiber has been built around ending those wars, putting Iraq and Afghanistan into our rearview mirrors and getting about the job of what the president has called nation-building here at home. And if the American people aren't going to hear the case vigorously argued by their top leaders and their commander-in-chief as to why American leadership and engagement with the world and fighting these terrorists over there rather than over here is absolutely essential to securing our own security and prosperity, then of course the American people, it's just natural for them to say, well, you know, bring them all home and let's get about the business of fixing America.
You know, And kind of adding on to that, is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict at the UN, Palestine comes and asks for statehood. Frankly, I can't believe it even got to that level. But where do we stand in that regard, and what should we have done to prevent that from happening?
Well, I think you've put your finger on it, that this was a case. I mean, this is something we knew was coming down the chute for a year now, Ty, and the president just let it drag on and on and on, and instead of putting his foot down and telling the Palestinians that this was never going to happen, and if it did happen, they would suffer some serious consequences, the president just let the Palestinians continue on with this, I think in the hope that it would add to the pressure on Israel and Prime Minister Netanyahu to make various concessions in order to get back to the negotiating table, which I think would have been a terrible mistake. At any rate, the president finally has done the right thing. He's said he's going to veto this effort if it comes to the Security Council. They've kind of bottled it up in the Security Council now. There's a new effort to get negotiations underway without any preconditions, which is what we wanted to see and what the Israelis have wanted to see. It's put the pressure back on the Palestinians, and that's where it ought to be. I think our Congress is helping a lot by threatening to cut off American assistance to the Palestinian Authority. We are, after all, the number one donor to the Palestinian. It's not the Arabs, it's not the Europeans, it's the United States that's the number one donors that's keeping that place alive. So I think we've got a lot of leverage, and it's about time that the president exercised it.
What a great idea. What a great idea.
Yeah, it's a novel idea.
I mean, what a concept, right? All right. We've been in Afghanistan for 10 years now. As I mentioned a moment ago, I love having the fight at their home, because if we're fighting them in their home, we can't. They can't help. They can't come get us here, or nearly not as much. Where are we at this point on the war on terror?
Ty, it depends, your perspective on that, where you sit. I was sitting in the White House on that terrible Tuesday morning 10 years ago.
Right.
I remember going home that night, walking across the bridges into Virginia with thousands of other people, like a bunch of refugees, black smoke billowing from the Pentagon, National Guardsmen on every street corner toting M-16s, F-16s flying overhead. And thinking just how close we were to our own society and civilization unraveling. It's a near miss kind of thing, how fragile it is. I remember then going into work the next day, and every single leader in the United States government, from the president to the vice president to everybody on down, believing it was only a matter of another few days, another few weeks, a month maybe, before there'd be a follow-on attack or two or three or four. If you told me then we'd go 10 years without another mass casualty attack by al-Qaeda, I'd say you were smoking something. And yet here we have, we've done it. So I think simply from that perspective of where we thought we'd be and where we've ended up now 10 years later, I think it's been quite a spectacular success. But again, as we said before, success does not equate to victory. And I think if we want victory, we're going to have to continue fighting these people so long as there's enough of them determined to plot and attack us and kill American citizens and to do so with the world's very worst weapons. We've got to stay resolved, stay vigilant, and stay at this.
Let me ask you this question. Being inside the White House for the Bush-Cheney administration, how often was there a serious threat from al-Qaeda or from terrorists? Was that something on a daily basis, weekly, monthly basis? How often was there a serious threat that you had to deal with?
The problem was how little we knew about the enemy that got us on 2001. So I can remember for the better part of a year coming in every day and my intelligence book being filled with case after case after case of a threat, of a new al-Qaeda threat against the United States. It was really simply overwhelming.
Now, that was daily?
What's that?
That was daily?
That was on a daily basis.
Wow.
Those threat reports that we were getting. Now, a lot of that was raw intelligence and proved not to be true and not to be the case, but we didn't know it at the time. So in the beginning, I'd say how little we knew. Once we got into this and our intelligence and military were able to acquire the kind of information we got, we put in a lot of the systems in terms of the Patriot Act and detentions and Guantanamo, where we were really putting in systems that were going to protect us, then obviously the number of threats began to reduce. We were able to see what were the real threats as opposed to simply noise and static from the outside, and the threat levels clearly went down. But they remain, and they're still very much there, and something of great concern. These guys are plotting every day.
We're talking today to John Hanna. He served as Vice President Dick Cheney's assistant for national security affairs. Mr. Hanna, is there a place where our listeners can go to find out more about you and your work and the organization that you represent right now?
If you go to the website for the Foundation of Defense of Democracies, I'm not sure. I think it's www.defenddemocracy.org. You ought to be able to find me and the rest of the terrific staff that's there that's dedicated to fighting this war. It's a group that was founded right after 9/11, and they've got a terrific bunch of scholars and intellectuals and former policymakers that are determined to try and figure out ways to keep the country safe.
Mr. Hanna, you are a great American. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Ty. Pleasure to be here.
All right.